From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made on April 3rd with the establishment of a new office dedicated to improving renewable energy projects in New York State. The Office of Renewable Energy Siting is the first of its kind. Its purpose is to streamline and expedite the siting and review of renewable energy projects in a timely manner. A key goal is to include input from local communities. And you know, there is almost always some kind of debate. Communities have been debating for years now in this state, often in rural areas, but not always, when it comes to, well, should a wind turbine go somewhere? What about solar arrays? What looks good? What doesn't? What's good for the landscape? What's good for the economy? There's been debate. Some of the complaints, sure, there's some merit. Some, not really. But it's important that the community can air this stuff out. And advocates of this new office say it will help New York meet its climate goals. Currently, there are dozens of renewable energy projects planned across the state. If you look at the entirety of the state, there's maybe 100 in various stages of development. But many people have questions about what the office will actually do, if it will fairly consider public feedback, and what it means for individual communities and pre-existing or potential projects that are planned for those communities. So this hour, let's talk about the mission here and the difficult steps that communities have to take before they decide and before our states decides what kind of energy we want, what we need, and where to put it. Neely Kelly is a veteran in these kinds of conversations. She's a renewable energy advocate and a community organizer. And I don't think we've talked in a long time now. It's been too long. Nice to have you back on the program.
Thanks so much, Evan. Great to be here.
David Alisea is New York lead organizing representative for the Sierra Club, who's also with us. Hi, David. Thanks for being with us.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
And Dominique Laputra is a resident of Caledonia who is with us as well. Dominique, welcome. Thanks for making the time for the program.
Thank you so much for having us on the show.
Neely Kelly, is there anyone in the state who's had more of these kinds of conversations in communities than you?
Well, I think as someone who was not affiliated with, a developer, I guess in the nonprofit world, like community organizing world, there were not that many, to be honest with you.
Yeah, I think we've talked about the ways that you want to reach out and truly understand when some communities sort of dig in and oppose projects, but we've seen other communities much more embracing of projects. So why don't you, I'll start with you, Neely, but I'd like to hear from our guests on this. Tell me what you see the broader mission with this new siting office and how you think it ought to be working.
So I think what it does is help streamline the process developers have to go through to get an approved permit for these large-scale renewables. And I think to be clear that we're talking about projects that are 25 megawatts or greater. And there's some gray area between the smaller 20 to 25 megawatt size projects. But I think what happened and is happening under Article 10 is that there's no uniform way for these projects that have a lot of similarities among them, between them. Like for, you know, there's some pretty decent standards the state has come up with and is putting out to the public for feedback on, so that every time there's a new 25 or greater megawatt solar project, they don't have to start all over with, well, how far should the setbacks be? How many panels should be per square foot? You know, it's like it really is supposed to standardize a lot of the things that can be standardized with ample opportunity for feedback and input from communities. And I think one thing for people to understand right now is that the state has not finalized any of these regulations. They've put proposals out there, and David is much more versed in the ins and outs and the technicalities of this new law 94C that created OREZ, Office of Renewable Energy Siting, the Office of Renewable Energy Siting, and so what the state is doing right now is giving people an opportunity to weigh in on these standards, and then by early next year they will have these standards that I don't know what the technical like word is for it. Like, it will be part of the law. So, you know, from one solar project to another, there will be standards for the setbacks and the size and things like that. Again, David's the technical expert here, but does that answer your question?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah. And David, you want to jump in?
Yeah. To build off what Neely is saying, what we've really seen in New York is that the state has firmly set its the direction of moving to 100% clean energy economy. By law, we need to get there by 2050. But in practice, you know, over the past 8 years or so where Article 10 has been in place, we haven't built a single renewable energy project. There's one under construction, so we have one. But the process has been so lengthy and so onerous and so sort of haphazard that the projects weren't getting built. And so if we're serious about meeting our climate goals, this new process, which keeps the timeline from application to the time of approval to 1 year, will really let us build renewables at the pace that we need to hit our climate goals. A substantial improvement over what we saw with Article 10. Article 10 intended to make things faster, but just did not follow through on it, the intentions that they tried to go for it.
So before I get Dominique's perspective as a resident of Caledonia, I want to read a letter to the editor that appeared in Syracuse on Syracuse.com and in their local paper. And it comes from Luke Daly from the town of Colton, who had this to say about this new office and some of these plans. Quote, "Many New York towns have already been targeted for industrial-scale wind and solar projects because of our large open areas, lower real estate costs, and less rigorous or the absence of zoning. Communities have been bullied, bribed, corrupted, strong-armed, and torn asunder by corporations hoping to capitalize on state and federal energy supports. These new state regulations intended to implement and accelerate the development process are not the answer. It's time to utilize the built environment, where this power is needed and used, and stop the sacrifice of our farmlands, fields, forests, and the residents that depend on them." End quote. That's from Luke Daly from Colton, writing in a letter to the editor published on Syracuse.com. You know, Neely, I know you've heard these kinds of concerns from people, and I think there's a couple of layers there I want to work through. First of all, one of the things that he's alleging is that the real winners here are big corporations, big money, and this is all capitalism running over people. How do you see that, Neely?
I think that is a perception, and I think those are buzzwords that like to be thrown around by the opposition. I do think that developers and corporations and the companies that are proposing these projects, and I'm somewhat new to the solar scene. As you know, I was pretty involved in trying to build support for a large-scale renewable wind project. And the capital required for wind turbines is, my understanding, is much higher than solar. And so when you're building large-scale wind, you have to have corporate money. You can't have like a nonprofit try and build a large-scale wind project. It's just not financially viable. And so I do think there is a responsibility by companies, developers, to really invest in engaging with the community. And as you know, I've been deeply committed to that because there's a lot of misinformation that can get out there so super quickly. And so there's that piece. And I also think that New York State, it's one of the most difficult places in the country to develop large-scale renewables. And so corporations and developers really can't go in and steamroll communities. Like, communities still have power. They have a tremendous amount of power under Article 10, and they have almost as much, if not the same, as in the new 94C process. And so, again, I think this is a matter of really education and connections with the people and the leaders in these communities, with the environmental groups that want to see these large-scale projects built, such as the Sierra Club and others, and with the developers themselves. Being accessible, providing opportunities for education. And I was listening to that letter, and I just thought that is just I should say too, I think it's important to make the distinction between good faith questions, because there are a lot of questions out there for people who really are genuinely curious and want to understand. And then there's definitely a very large number of people and vocal number of people out there who just bring up these points over and over and over and over to give people the wrong perception and provide misinformation. And so I think it really is on us and the developers who want to see these projects move forward to make those connections and do that education and show them that that is not the case.
Okay. And then the other aspect of that I'll ask both of you about, Neely, the letter indicates use the built environment. Don't use farmland, forests, fields. My bias that I will admit is that confuses me a little bit. I'm not trying at all to sort of disrespect rural land ownership and property rights, but it seems to me to be logical to look to those kinds of spaces, not to wrest it away from people, but to find suitable places for wind or solar, as opposed to the built environment, which is going to offer maybe its own sort of stickiness at times. I could be wrong. How do you see it, Neely?
I think if you talk to rural farmers and landowners, they see this as an opportunity to support their communities and to support their farms. And if they want to do it, and again, many are eager to do so, then they should. And David can speak to this more directly, but the truth is we have got to have these large-scale projects. We cannot meet our energy demands and our energy needs, both to address climate change and then to follow the law in New York State, the climate laws and legislation, with rooftop solar. We just can't do it. We need these large-scale renewables. David, do you want to say anything? You want to add to that?
Yeah. What I would say is I live in Wayne County, and I moved out here for the open space. I love being able to drive to farmland and enjoy that. I love the views. So I understand where people come to from that. And at the same time, what Neely said, I think spot on. Farmers are trying to make a living. Keeping a small family farm alive is incredibly difficult. And a lot of times this offers a tremendous lifeline to them. And it also offers benefits to an entire community in terms of tax payments to the towns and the schools, in terms of, a farmer gets a lease payment, they're going to invest that money locally. And so there's tremendous benefits that I see. And at the end of the day, I'm not going to fault a farmer for trying to keep his business alive in a way that's really innocuous. There's no, significant harm caused by this. So why not let him do that, or let him or her do that? I think New York is doing all that it possibly can to do what that author was saying, to try and build on the built environment. There is a new program that's going to be working to site more renewables on brownfields and other disturbed sites. There's trickiness. Not every site of that nature is appropriate for renewables in terms of the electric grid, in terms of what's on there, what type of cleanup needs to be done first. New York has a very aggressive solar rooftop program. We want to get a million homes with solar by 2025, and we are working on that, moving forward to that. And we also have an incredible offshore wind program down off of Long Island. But even with all those efforts, you do the math, and we need wind and solar on land in rural communities as part of the solution. And it also means that these communities are then part of the benefits of it. If we don't do this, it means the benefits of renewable only go to those who can afford solar on their roofs, only to downstate where they're building offshore wind. So we have an opportunity in rural communities to be part of this, and to not jump on it, I think, is a loss for these communities.
Well, Dominique Laputra is a Caledonia resident. How do you see this issue, Dominique?
Well, first of all, I want to give you a little background. I taught at RIT, at NTID specifically, for 36 years. In the last 15 years that I was there, I taught courses related to climate change, the science, the global and local dangers, social justice and equity, and potential solutions. Then I retired, and I've been retired for 7 years. I'm a resident of Caledonia. I love Caledonia. It's a beautiful rural community. I love the spirit of the town. I love the people that are here. This is a very generous, kind, caring group of people. And back in November, we decided to have, my husband and I decided to open our home to our community and ask that people come to discuss Horseshoe Solar in particular, and that everyone would be welcomed, no matter what their opinion was, to come and to discuss. But we were providing a safe place for people to come where the discussion would be polite and kind and compassionate and thoughtful. And people came. At the first meeting, we had 20 people. Many people came with concerns. Unfortunately, there were experts in the room that were able to dispel some concerns. In addition to that, we had two more meetings, one in December and one in January, before COVID shut us down in February. So we had between 20 and 30 people who were discussing, working together, looking for consensus, looking for solutions, and looking for accuracy in facts. So that's kind of where I'm coming from. I would like to note that I agree with David that the benefits that the community will garner from this are many. For one thing, we'll be drawing down on carbon emissions in the atmosphere locally and eventually globally, because locally is globally. In addition to that, we know that New York State is facing a $59 billion shortfall because of COVID, and that means basically that taxes will increase on property and small farms will be at an increased risk, and they need to be able to diversify. I've spoken to a number of farmers in this area who are telling me that not all of the land that is being mentioned as a possible land for this particular project is prime land. There is some that is degraded, not productive, and careful siting can make use of degraded land and then regenerate that land, because the land is very little disturbed by the installation of solar panels. Solar panels are not polluting. They don't affect water. They don't affect the air with pollution. There are proposals to graze sheep and have honeybees and honey farmers be on the land, and that will help rejuvenate the land as well. We also know that our climate's changing locally, which ultimately will affect crops, the water in the area, and food production. And we need to mitigate climate change locally with careful planning. So revenues from the pilot will keep the town afloat and help taxes stay down and help better fund schools and enhance life in Caledonia, especially given COVID-19 disruptions.
David Alisea, can we just get a sense for before we get into anything more specific, just the wider view of New York State in general? When we look at these kinds of cleaner energy projects, what is either already in development or in proposal? How many are we talking about around the state?
So there's about 100 projects in process in New York State. There comes about to locally about a dozen or so in the Article 10 process, which is the old siting process. And I would say that's actually slowed. The new projects have slowed down a little bit between COVID and sort of all the delays around that, as well as these new rules. A lot of people are sort of holding steady, trying to figure out, does it make sense to move a project out now or not? And the benefits are, when you look in sort of aggregate in the nine county Genesee Finger Lakes region, you know, with a dozen or so projects, you're talking, you know, $10 million plus a year in tax payments for those gifts, $10 million a year plus landowner payments, and literally thousands of union jobs. Those are, you know, these companies are required to source locally, to hire union firms, pay prevailing wage. So those are good jobs. Those are jobs with benefits, with good pay. And in turn, that means, you know, someone's getting a good job with good benefits. They're going and spending that money in the community, whether it's gassing out their car, getting food at a local restaurant, just, you know, getting stuff for their kids. And so it's the benefit to us locally is huge, and it's critical to hitting our climate goals on top of it. And so I kind of really do see it as a win-win scenario, and especially like Dominic was saying, in today's economic climate, if we can do something to help the economic climate and the environmental climate, it just seems like a no-brainer to me.
What's the timeline for most of these projects actually getting completed?
Yeah, so the ones that are furthest along right now are in Article 10, so it's a long process. Those wouldn't probably start construction until late 2021, 2022 time frame. We expect once the new process is finalized, we would see more projects moving at a better speed. And so I think, you know, by 2022, 2023, hopefully it's not just one or two projects, but hopefully we can get, you know, a couple moving every year in our region. But right now, Article 10 takes 5 to 8 years. And so we have this sort of backlog that's been slowly moving through through the process. And hopefully we can speed that up.
And David, ultimately, what kind of, I mean, the impact in one sense is obvious. You're moving in a different direction with energy and what we're extracting or not and what we're using. But what percentage, I mean, are we talking about actually transferring over? And what is realistic for New Yorkers who want to see their state sort of transform in that direction?
Yeah. So to give you an idea, right now we're at roughly, give or take a few percentage points, 30% renewable electricity today. Our state has a mandatory target of moving to 70% by 2030 and 100% by 2040 in the electric sector. And so if with what we have proposed right now, we get close to 70, not quite, but we get up there. And I'll be realistic, not every project, that some projects are on paper, they've been sitting for a while, they're not going to come to fruition. So we're going to need more than that to get to 70. We're going to need to increase, you know, from that 100 to more than that. And then that 70 to 100%, we're going to have to work really hard to get to as well. So we have 20 years total to get to 100%, but we need to, you know, build a lot more renewable energy than we have now. And I think it's also important to look at the, like, what's the alternative? And so the alternative is, you know, right now already we import some power from Canada and Pennsylvania. The way that our clean energy targets are set up, we're going to have to import more power if we don't build any new renewables in New York State. That means every time you will be paying your utility bill, you'll be sending more and more money out of our region, out of our state, out of our country. And so, you know, we can do that technically. There's probably a limit to how much you can import. But why would you do that when you can be investing in your own, investing in New York jobs, in New York families? So those are the choices that we really have, you know, sort of in front of us.
Looking at the list of public meetings, listeners, if you want to learn more, participate, according to the ORES, the Office of Renewable Energy Sitings, you've got a chance starting next week on November 17th. Buffalo's got a virtual public hearing. On the 18th, Rochester has a virtual public hearing from 5 to 9 p.m. The 19th, Watertown's in person. The 20th, Albany in person. Stony Brook in person on the 23rd. More information about these events at the office's website. It's ORES.ny.gov. ORES.ny.gov. We're talking about where these kinds of energy projects go and what's appropriate and how they might make serious change for our state in the future when it comes to the energy we use. You're hearing from David Alisea, who's New York lead organizing representative for the Sierra Club. Neely Kelly is a renewable energy advocate and a community organizer. Dominique Laputra is a Caledonia resident. If you want to call the program or email us with questions or comments. We'd love to hear from you. It's 844-295-TALK. It's toll-free, 844-295-8255. It's 263-WXXI if you're calling from Rochester, 263-9994, or our email is connections@WXXI.org. I'm Evan Dawson. Friday on The Next Connections. On Tuesday evening, Rochester City Council unanimously approved Connor Dwyer Reynolds as the first executive director of Rochester's PAB, the Police Accountability Board. That decision came after a tense confirmation hearing and some questions about the board's independence. We talked to the new executive director about his goals for the PAB and the state of police community relations in Rochester. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Tom sends a note to the program. A listener named Tom says, if solar panels are so clean, why do they produce so much waste? He points us to an article 2 years old from Forbes.com. And I know, David, you've heard that question before. What's the reality on solar panels and waste?
So I think it's important to note that there is no form of electricity generation that is impact-free. And so we're always sort of in the space of trying to do what's least impact. Solar panels are typically will last in 20 and 30 years. Some of them can go on longer, but in sort of the expected lifetime is that time frame. There are more and more efforts being put into solar panel recycling. It's a nascent industry, mostly because there's not many solar panels that are 30 years old. And so it wouldn't make sense to open a full-fledged recycling facility today. It'd be hard to find enough panels out there. But there are people looking into it, people setting up the processes, people setting up the startups to do that. We expect that to be a huge industry. I also think it's really important to note that in New York State, all of these utility scale projects need to put up bonds to take down these projects at the end of their lifespan, or if they are in some weird way abandoned, they have to put that, that's held by the towns. And so at the end of the lifespan, either the developer themselves can tap into that fund or the town can tap into that fund to take those panels down and recycle them. And so that's something that we don't do with pretty much any other type of development or construction. We rarely require such holistic planning. So I think we're holding renewable energy to a very high standard, and these companies are good with that. They understand that. And why I understand that there's, you know, maybe we want to have zero impact. It's just not feasible. We have to have a little bit. This is one of the best ways to have a minimal impact.
Yeah. Neely, I know you've heard that brought up as well. How do you address that?
I think David said it right away. It's a new industry. We don't have any old solar panels to recycle yet. And when you look at the history of fossil fuel use, coal, especially like coal companies weren't doing this, and the impact of coal, like you can't even compare the difference in pollution. And New York is almost, I believe, the last coal plant just shut down. Is that correct? Or we've got maybe one more, but we're almost 100% off coal in New York State. And so I always feel like, I think it's a really good question. I think it's a good question. As long, again, as it's asked in good faith and it's not used as, you know, a reason to not build solar because it's a straw man argument.
Okay. Again, listeners, 844-295-TALK. It's toll free, 844-295-8255, 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester. It's 263-9994. Dominique Laputra is a Caledonia resident who talked a little bit about the project that has generated some controversy. I want to talk a little bit about this. And I'll quote now journalist Gabriel Pietrarazzo, who wrote about this for I think Finger Lakes One is where he wrote this. But let me go ahead and quote. Quote, indigenous peoples are still fighting to protect their ancestral lands and burial sites of significance, just like the Seneca Nation at the boundary between Rush and Caledonia in Livingston County. On Indigenous Peoples Day, a grassroots effort with some members of the Seneca Nation at the Tonawanda Reservation mobilized a rally against Horseshoe Solar of Invenergy, a project being conducted by a six-person development team stationed out of Ithaca. And they quote Dr. Joe Stallman, a museum director of the Seneca Iroquois National Museum, who has been relaying additional information about the historical significance of the territory. He represents the Seneca Nation across 183 other recognized sovereign nations that collectively span across 50 million acres of land as part of the National Association of Tribal Historic Preservation Officers. And he says that too often Native people have not put their foot down and haven't tried to enforce what is theirs. And in this case, it's not even a case of NIMBY. It's a case of NIMGY. It's not in my backyard. It's not in our graveyard. It's not in our boundaries, not in our ancestral burial space. And they want to see this changed and the project either scrapped or moved. David, I know you're familiar with those concerns, and I want you first to let our listeners know how you see the dispute that has taken up there.
So the concerns that are being voiced by members of the Seneca and Tonawanda Seneca communities are really important, should be heard. But from my understanding, from Sierra Club's understanding, what we have heard, the nations are still in working through a consultation process. There is a formal consultation process that is required by Article 10. It is ongoing. And so we really hope that through that process, the concerns that are being raised can be addressed, and either the project can be shifted, things can be adjusted, so that all parties involved in Invenergy and the nation come to a place where we can allow renewable energy to move forward while respecting tribal land rights and our ancestors. Sierra Club is not involved in that consultation process. I'm not privy to all of the details, but I think we should let that process play out, that official consultation process. And in the meantime, realize, there are many projects moving forward. There are going to be projects that are cited appropriately and well. And there's a point for this process to figure out how can we do this well? How can we avoid these types of conflicts? But we need to let that process play.
Yeah, and forgive my ignorance. I'm going to ask just the first thing that came to my mind when I started to read about this dispute, David, which was this. Certainly, I think that you, Neely, so many others who've worked on these issues are doing it in good faith. You're doing it with intentions that will, I from my perspective, serve the people of New York State and frankly, the world. And if we're going to do this, if we're going to figure this out for future generations. And I know it's not easy when there are communities that sometimes organize against. Sometimes that organization against projects is a little frivolous, and sometimes it's a case like this where, if someone comes to you and says, "Hey, did you know that this project is on ancestral burial sites?" I don't understand why people don't just go, "Whoa, I had no idea. We're just going to pick it up and move it somewhere else." I mean, like, am I missing something about that, David?
There's a consultation process that is happening to survey the site, to understand what is there that is being done in coordination and collaboration with the nations. Typically, I think this is important to know, developers will look at, this is a project of 1,000 acres. They will study 3,000, 4,000, 5,000 acres to determine, and they look at everything from, burial grounds to wetlands. They look at all of this, and they know that they have to shift their project based on the outcomes of whatever those studies are done. And so, I think they're going through that process, and I think we should wait for the conclusion of it and hear what the Seneca and the Tonawanda Seneca say at the conclusion of that process, based on the data and sort of what they can come up with. But they're in conversation right now, and I think we should give them that opportunity to have that conversation directly between Invenergy and the nation.
Sure. It's not a done deal, in other words.
Yeah. A done deal. This project needs to have that consultation process finalized before construction could ever start.
Yeah, go ahead, Neely.
Yeah, I just wanted to clarify one thing you said, Evan, about building on burial sites. Horseshoe Solar is not, the project area is not on a known and designated burial site at all. But the concern is that because there were indigenous and native villages there for, that have not been tracked, that for which there is no known historical records, that they might come upon something, but the designated burial ground, that is not where this project is currently designed to go. And I will just reiterate, like, reiterating the importance of respecting that Invenergy and the nation, Seneca Nation and Tonawanda Band of Seneca, are engaging in a consultation process that needs to play out.
All right, let me work through some feedback from listeners. This is Barb in Byron first. Go ahead, Barb.
Hi, thank you. I live on Mill Pond Road here in Byron, and in front of me is a very large pond, and then there's the park. And that's on the other side of the park is where they're saying they're putting solar panels. And then it's between 262, Route 262, and Swamp Road, if anybody knows that area. There's also a cemetery there. And then you've got the mobile home park right next to it also. I've asked, why do they have to put it so close to our homes where we're going to be able to see this in the park? It's going to devalue our property. And they say they have got the people that are going to be bonded, but what if they go out of business? And why does it have to be so close to a park where we fish and have fun? And I just don't get it. Nobody in Byron really wants this anyway, so.
Okay.
You can help me.
David Neely, someone want to jump in?
So I can jump in. You know, I'm not familiar. I know of the project in Byron, but I don't know any of the details. So I can't speak to any specifics. I think the important thing to know is that wherever you build something, there's going to be something nearby. We live in an inhabited state. There are people that live everywhere, and so I think it's trying to figure out where are the least impact places and what can we do to have the least impact. And it's really typical with these projects. You know, they are required to have setbacks from residential property lines. They are required to do screening. They are required to do a number of things to minimize their impact. But I think we see it in so many parts, in so many other different arenas where you may live somewhere and, you know, if it's zoned residential and they decide to build a tract of homes in that farm next door, like, that happens to people. I think that the development happens. I think we hold renewable energy developers to a pretty high standard in terms of trying to screen and hide their development. And it's not permanent. These projects are, again, 20 to 30 years. The bonds are held by the town. So if a company goes bankrupt, these things happen. The towns have that money. They can access it to take care of the property, to do that. And I think we're holding renewable energy to a standard that we don't hold pretty much any other development to.
Okay. Neely, do you want to add to that?
I don't. I mean, I guess the other, so yes, I do. The community engagement piece that developers are required to do, to go back to, I think there's a perception out there that because there's some confusion around 94C, because again, the regulations have not been fully implemented yet. Again, the state is still getting feedback on just the regulations and the standards. And then, you know, the process is really clear that there is opportunity for engagement and feedback from community members. And so both through the developer and through the state, like the public comment period through the Public Service Commission, like that's still going to happen. And so this is where community members have the opportunity to raise these specific concerns.
Okay. Let me get Kasai in Rochester next on the phone. Go ahead, Kasai.
Hi. Good afternoon. I got a couple of questions about the science of it. And I hear a lot about the technical, like how to apply this technology in our day-to-day life. But from what I learn or I understand is the wind is mechanical energy. Also, the solar is electromagnetic energy, which is, you know, what we call light, right? Or ultraviolet, whatever they call it. But as far as I understand, there is different forms of energy. Like heat is another form of energy. That's what we see in the environment. That's why we say the global is warming. So is there any new research that works on grabbing this huge amount of heat energy in the environment and convert it to our electrical or other forms of energy for our needs? If there is one, then we learn about it so we can ask our future politicians, including Joe Biden, to work on that so we have a better environmental control in the future. Because look at the solar panels. They make the houses more like less aesthetic, like the look is not that good. And the same thing with the wind farms. There's a lot of questions about that. There's a huge tower standing behind your house. That's not going to be pretty. So I'm just wondering if there's a new research that works on in a better way of controlling the environment. Thank you.
Okay, I mean, because I'm not sure. I'll let David jump in. I mean, look, my bias has been clear. I think all those things look great. I just do. I think the wind turbines and the solar panels look really good, and I think it looks like the present and the future. But I understand some people disagree. And David, do you want to address other parts of the call there?
Yeah, I think there was a couple of things he was getting into there. And I think what I would say is that there are going to be new clean energy technologies in the future. Like there are people trying to figure out how you can do wave and tidal. There are interesting solar kite ideas. There's all sorts of interesting ideas that are out there in the future. But we need to reduce emissions like yesterday. We are getting closer and closer to that point where we are not going to be able to avoid some of the worst impacts of climate change. And so we need to implement the solutions that are viable today. And so wind and solar are both technically viable. Like they work, they function, you can run economies on 100% wind and solar with the proper storage. And it's also economically viable. So a new solar farm, a new wind farm is cheaper than a new gas plant. And so we're at the point where we can do this, or we can delay another 10 years and hope the climate's okay and see what happens. Like that to me seems like a reckless decision when we're dealing with the immediacy of climate change.
Okay. Let me get back to your phone calls. Jim and Roger.
Can I add?
Yeah, please, Neely, go ahead.
A couple things about that. So
yep.
I wanted to bring up heat pumps and geothermal energy. I don't know if that's exactly what he was talking about when he was saying, pull heat from the air, because this would actually be, well, for geothermal, it's like tapping into the heat in the ground. And certainly to transform our heating systems in New York State, we're going to have to go to geothermal and heat pumps, mostly. There are other alternatives as well. But the thing I think it's also important for people to understand, and David, correct me if I'm wrong, but the numbers we're talking about for, 70% by 2030 and 100% by 2040 from our electricity sector, my understanding is that is not actually taking into account the fact that we have to move our heating and transportation systems over to the electricity system, because they're not now. And so, I just want to impress upon people like how critical it is that we get these large scale renewable projects permitted and built to meet existing demand, because we have to figure out how to meet increasing demand on our electricity system. Thank you.
Okay. Let me go ahead and get Jim in Rochester next. Go ahead, Jim.
Hi. Hope everyone's doing well. I have several questions now that I've listened to somebody else's question. The first is regarding the lines to the transformers and stuff like that, like the windmills or the solar projects. Are the lines going to be put underground or above ground? And it seems to make more sense while you're doing this for the first time to put them underground. The second question is it possible to have some of these projects coexist, like to have a solar wind farm, like putting the panels on the actual windmill itself, or by possibly using our own coastal regions to gather power, whether it's through Lake Erie or Lake Ontario. And then the third one is, when I was a kid going through fifth or sixth grade, we were taken on a tour through Guinea so that we learned how it operated, safety systems, and things like that. So is it possible to also have some of these stations be tutorials for kids' classes and people and what have you, so that we can learn how it's done and then take a lot of the questions out of the process?
Jim, thank you. I guess I'll kick that to David as well. Go ahead, David.
Yeah, I'm going to work my way backwards. I wrote down the question. I think that the example about education, I think, is so important, valuable, and I think this will vary by community to community, and I think it's something that – so communities will typically negotiate a host community benefit agreement with a developer, and so that is an opportunity for them, for community to say, these are our priorities, this is what we would like, what type of benefits can you help fund above just like pure, you know, tax revenue. And there's actually a wind farm in central New York, I know, that has the town asked for them to build a small, one room museum. They run tours for schools from K through 12 and including college. I actually went there as a graduate student as part of a class where they will walk you through and teach you about the wind turbines. And it was like, it was the coolest thing ever. It was the first time like seeing a wind turbine up close when I was in grad school. And so those are, I think, definite opportunities and things that happen. And then, you know, in terms of co-location, I think that we're seeing a lot of is solar and wind with battery storage. In New York, we don't see a lot of solar and wind together just because the chances that you have a windy place where you get a lot of sun and you have a transmission line is sort of like, it's just a rare combination. But there are definitely opportunities to do battery storage and renewables, and that is definitely a growing area.
All right, let me squeeze in one more phone call. It's Don in Rochester. Go ahead, Don.
Hey, listen, your panel, I say this with love, but you are doing a horrible job of being ambassadors of solar power. First of all, shouldn't the target year be less than the life of these projects? In other words, we have, 20 years or 30 years to get to 100% solar? We're building projects right now that have a 25-year lease, a 25-year lifespan. That makes no sense. You know, it's always been this way ever since, you know, the late 70s when my father looked into buying a wind turbine, and the payback period was further out by far than the repayment. So you never made enough money by not paying the power company to offset the cost of the turbine. So, you know, the other thing is, you guys were talking about the permitting process, and, you know, people should know that there are so many opportunities in New York State, and, you know, even there's a federal, you know, NEPA, National Environmental Policy Act, that would also come into play. And the New York State version of that is a secret law, State Environmental Quality Review, where people have at least three chances at a public hearing for any project of you know, a sizable nature, like a, you know, utility scale solar farm. So yeah, I really wish that the solar industry, you know, were a lot more lively. I became sort of peripherally involved, but to be honest, as a consultant, there's not enough money in it for me because the production is very slow. There's a lot of, you know, pre-planning to do, but nobody wants to pay for it.
So. Well, and I got to jump in, Don, give some time. David Alisea, go ahead. We're down to about our last 80 seconds. Go ahead.
Yeah, what I think I would say to that is, you know, our 2050 goal is a long-term goal, but we need to be adopting renewable energy today. Like, again, the immediacy of climate change, we need to put solutions in place today. And the fact is that it is economical now. The payback period, you mentioned, were true 30 years ago. But I think I have...
Can, Can I interject?
I was going to say, Dominique has solar on her own house. You can prove
that's
how it works.
Right.
Yeah, go ahead.
Very quickly, we have two solar arrays and geothermal that provide all of the heat, hot water, electricity needs of the house year-round. Our electric bill is somewhere around $160 a year, and that's because of service connections. We started the process in 2007 of putting these on one by one, one array, then another array, then the geothermal first, then one array, then another array. And within the next 7 years, the entire thing will be paid for. And it's a matter of planning. So it's a question of, do you spend the money now or do you spend the money later? So if it's possible for your family to have self-facing solar and have the ability to plan over a period of time, it is doable. Not only doable, it's lucrative.
Listeners, learn more about what's going on with the Office of Renewable Energy Siting through these public hearings and events. The list is at their website, ores.ny.gov. That's Dominique Laputra, Caledonia resident. Thank you, Dominique.
Thank you.
David Alisea from the Sierra Club. Thank you, David.
Yeah, thank you.
Neely Kelly, nice talking to you. I know you're doing a lot of work in these communities. Let's talk again soon.
Sounds great. Thanks so much, Evan.
All right. A lot going on across New York State, about 100 projects. Rob Braden, engineer. Megan Mack, producer. I'm Evan Dawson. We'll talk to you tomorrow.